citizens of the digital cosmos, prepare yourselves for an explosive episode of the Outlaw Crypto Podcast. In episode 10, we welcome the enigmatic and brilliant Luke Parker, also known as Kayaba Nerve, who will unravel the mysteries of Sarai, full chain membership proofs in Monero, and his groundbreaking work on de-anonymizing the Dero network. This episode is not for the faint of heart as we dive deep into the labyrinthine conspiracies that the gangster computer god doesn't want you to uncover. Luke Parker, the fearless warrior of crypto, brings us Sarai, a decentralized exchange like no other. Imagine a platform where you can swap Bitcoin, Ethereum, DAI, and Monero with unparalleled security and efficiency. Sarai is the ultimate fortress against the prying eyes of the technocratic overlords, a decentralized network without central authority or admin keys. Every aspect is open source, from the code to the validator set, ensuring that financial power is truly in the hands of the people. But that's not all. Sarai's cryptographic stack, written in Rust and meticulously audited, is a marvel of modern technology. This advanced system uses collateralized multi-signature wallets to ensure financial security, and its architecture is designed for efficiency and scalability. Luke Parker has created a masterpiece that stands as a beacon of hope for those seeking financial freedom from the clutches of the gangster computer god conspiracy. And then there's Monero, the privacy coin that fights for your right to financial secrecy. Luke's work on full chain membership proofs in Monero is a testament to his commitment to privacy and security. By integrating Monero into Sarai, Luke has shown the world that privacy coins are not just a niche interest, but a vital component of our fight against digital surveillance. But the intrigue doesn't stop there. Luke Parker has also turned his gaze upon the Dero network, uncovering its vulnerabilities and exposing the flaws that compromise its users' privacy. With his keen intellect and relentless pursuit of truth, Luke has shown us how the Dero network's reuse of randomness for encryption can be exploited, revealing the sender, amount, receiver, and message of transactions. His discoveries highlight the critical importance of secure cryptographic protocols in maintaining our digital freedom. So, join us on episode 10 of the Outlaw Crypto Podcast as Luke Parker, Kayaba Nerve himself, takes us on a journey through the cutting edge of decentralized technology.
Welcome back to another episode of the Outlaw Crypto Podcast. I'm your host, Paranoia Machinery. This is a podcasting 2.0 podcast, which means that we accept value for value donations. You can stream sats on the Fountain app. You can boost on the Fountain app. And since we're a privacy first podcast, we also accept Monero and a variety of other privacy coins. Today, my guest is Luke Kayaba Parker, who is the developer that's behind the Sarai DEX and actually caused a shitstorm last week with his paper that he published about breaking Dero. And we have him on the show here to talk about his discoveries and then also to let us know some progress on Sarai. Luke, how are you, man? Thanks for coming on the show.
Yeah, happy to. Doing well, just busy with everything going on.
Nice. So, like, what is it you're working on? Because you're working on a ton of stuff right now. You're doing Sarai. You're doing vulnerability reports for other blockchains.
Yeah. So I generally work as a security researcher. It's actually how I funded most of my work on Sarai, security research and so on. I'm currently doing Sarai. I'm currently doing full chain membership proofs for Monero. I'm currently apparently still doing some security research on the side whenever it comes up. And then I have my own one personal project I'm still trying to push forward. So yeah, a few different things going on.
Yeah, it sounds like you're extremely busy. I forget who it was that I interviewed. One of my recent interviews, somebody was talking about how like, wow, he's a young guy. And like a lot of the future of Monero is resting on his shoulders and stuff like that with the full chain membership proofs. And then also the DEX. How are things going on both fronts?
Yeah. So full chain membership proofs have actually been going really well. a lot of the, there's several layers to it. You know, there's the underlying cryptographic proof, then there's the arguments we call the proof with, then there's the nice high level API so wallets can integrate it, so on and so on. So there's all of these different layers to it. The underlying cryptographic proof is actually going really well. We recently had security proofs done by Aaron Feikert, formerly known as SerangNother. So they actually published the security proofs there. So now we kind of have the academic grounds for it. We're trying to get those security proofs reviewed. There is a full implementation that's likely ready for auditing. If it's not quite there, it's almost there. So going to start scoping that out. The circuit, the kind of program that we're running in zero knowledge in order to achieve full chain membership. That's been implemented, I believe. So yeah, that's making a lot of good progress.
Amazing. And are you working by yourself, or you mentioned SerangNother, but are you working with, like, with other people, or is it just you guys?
Yeah. So, Aaron is over at CypherStack nowadays, which is a consulting group who does a lot of audits for Monero, the Monero ecosystem, other cryptography projects, so on and so on. So Aaron is being contracted via CypherStack frequently in this work, though we're not directly collaborating. I am also working with another Monero developer, Justin Berman, who is handling most of the C++ side and is great.
And I guess for a layman like myself, like, how soon you predict that we'll see it, like, on the end user end?
Regarding what the user notices, regarding performance,
regarding like when full membership proofs will be, like, active, like in wallets, and I'll be able to send a transaction and have, like, the whole anonymity set of the whole chain.
Yeah, so my hope was to be code ready after about 6 months, which was a month or two ago. I practically adjusted that to 6 months to a year because there's always going to be delays, and other people were less optimistic as I was. But my hope was to be code ready after about 6 months and moving into review and audits. Currently, yeah, I think we are actually likely to be code ready within, say, 8 months, but it's hard for me to tell because I'm not handling the C++ side of things. So okay. I'm kind of just trying to evaluate that as an observer. But once, you know, that 8 month period is up, if we are actually code ready, then it just shifts into other people reviewing the code and making sure the necessary audits are done. One of the things we're doing, though, is we're parallelizing the audit. So, you know, as one section of code completes, we can immediately start auditing it. And then as the next section completes, we can move to auditing that. So hopefully we're not waiting, you know, a further year for audits. We're just wrapping up the last ones.
With the full chain membership proofs, like, the review process is pretty intensive, right? Like, I mean, people are going to try to, like, exploit it and that kind of thing. Like, does that take a long time to go through that process?
It probably will take a few months to be reviewed. But the cryptographic code is something that I'm doing my best to write in an exceptionally clear fashion, just so it's easy to understand and review. And also, so it's clear that there aren't mistakes, because, you know, if it was this opaque, oh yeah, this one line, it's 5,000 words. Go read it, have fun. No, that's not going to be easy to audit, easy to review, easy to understand, and it's very likely to have mistakes. So the cryptographic work is being done in my opinion, as clear as I can make it in order to facilitate that review and ensure security.
And then, as I understand it, like, the full chain membership proofs were originally planned to be part of the Seraphis upgrade, correct?
Mm-hmm.
And you guys, I guess, have changed the timeline on that and decided to implement full chain membership proofs, like, first?
Right. So full chain membership proofs prior required Seraphis.
Okay.
Seraphis changes how the keys and what we call today key images work.
Mm-hmm.
The more generic term would be the linking tag or nullifier. Nullifier is what a lot of other ZK projects use. The generic term that Monero has settled on is linking tag. So full chain membership proofs were designed for the Seraphis modified output key and linking tag format. The work, which was novel a couple months ago, was applying the full chain membership proof to the existing Monero output key and key image format. So that means we don't have to force this migration. And not only do we not have to force this migration, we don't have to wait for some migration. Though with how the work has been proceeding, I'm not sure if we'll still see the Seraphis migration to the Seraphis protocol. It would have been a hard migration. It would have invalidated old addresses. There's a lot of reasons why the migrations are bad in general. And with this work, not only does it achieve the same, a lot of the same goals, it also doesn't have that migration, doesn't force everyone to make new addresses, doesn't invalidate old ones, so on and so on. So we could still move to the Seraphis protocol for some efficiency gain, but I don't think there's going to be enough efficiency gain to justify it. And then the only other consideration is, no, that's actually it. It's just, I think it's just going to end up a minor efficiency gain that isn't worth it. So we are still looking at the Seraphis code base, you know, all of the new clean code for building transactions, managing multisigs, this entire environment. But for the Seraphis protocol, this modified output key definition and this modified linking tag definition, in my opinion, it's likely those get put to the side because the performance of this is competitive enough.
So I guess like the Monero roadmap's kind of adapted or evolved a little bit.
Yeah, we'll see if things keep up.
And then I guess like the other big thing that you're working on is Sarai, and everyone is waiting for DEXs in the Monero ecosystem due to the delistings. And then also like we just saw local Monero close down. With local Monero, it was like one of the only like peer-to-peer on and off ramps for fiat currency to Monero and vice versa. In the last like week or two, Havino launched and people are starting to play around with Havino. When can we expect to see Sarai like in a state where we can start playing with it as Monero users?
Yeah, so we've been trying to do a couple test nets and we've been resolving some issues at scale with those test nets. Currently my time, and by currently I mean like rather immediately, my time has been spent actually on the Ethereum integration and making sure that's ready to go. But as we continue improving performance and identifying the issues that are popping up at scale, unfortunately they're not popping up in our smaller test environments, the plan is just to do another test net, and if that one ends up stable, wallets would start integrating off of it, ideally, such as Cake Wallet, who has agreed to integrate Sarai. And once Cake Wallet has done their integration, all of this, of course, being over testnet, they may or may not publish it for public testing. I honestly don't know. But yeah, it's just kind of that. It's, you know, doing testnets, making sure the architecture works, letting people integrate, letting the integrators decide how they want to test it, and all leading towards the point where it's robust enough and proper enough that we can launch it on mainnet.
And then I guess with Havino, it's like a BISC fork. It's kind of like an app, peer-to-peer network. With Sarai, it's going to be like its own blockchain, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Can you kind of describe the architecture of Sarai?
Yeah. So, sorry, it's just that ends up an expensive question. Yeah. So there is the Sarai blockchain, which sort of acts as like an execution layer. It actually executes the swaps and decides the ordering they should be done in and ensures everyone agrees on the current state of the liquidity pools. It also handles validators, you know, staking and unstaking and deciding who the next set of validators is, so on and so on. Each validator for an external network, so if you're running a validator and you're validating over Bitcoin, or if you're validating over Ethereum, and to be clear, this does not mean you're mining Bitcoin or you are an Ethereum validator with 32 Ether. It just means for the Sarai network, you are running a Bitcoin node and reporting all of those events. You would also run a piece of software called the coordinator. The coordinator is not the centralized thing. It's just coordinates with other validators, coordinators about the state of Bitcoin. So like when a new Bitcoin block comes in, you would talk with your coordinator, would talk with all of the other Bitcoin validators, coordinators, and be like, hey, we all see this block, right? It's not just me. And then when they all agree that, yeah, we all see this Bitcoin block, it would get reported to Sarai proper, so on and so on. And then when Sarai proper is like, hey, this Sarai Bitcoin has been burnt, you know, send Bitcoin out to this address, it would coordinate with the others in order to produce the necessary signature to actually send out that Bitcoin. So we kind of got this Sarai blockchain, which handles the swaps and is what users need to be concerned with. And then internally, we have this coordinator service, which is how validators talk to each other. And then we have a few other services like, you know, the processor, which just processes the Bitcoin chain, gets all of the data from it, puts it into the format we want it, and reports it up the chain, so on and so on.
Okay. And with the structure of Sarai being like a proof of stake chain and then having liquidity pools, is this going to like facilitate a user experience for trading that's similar to like a centralized exchange more?
The goal is more Uniswap than, you know, like a full centralized exchange. We're not currently doing any order books and we're not going for that ultra low latency and futures products. No, God, no. Okay. but what we do want to say is like, a Uniswap-esque environment in that here's a liquidity pool. You can just send coins in and immediately get coins out. You don't have to wait. There's not, oh, one other person made a trade at this time, therefore you have to redo your order entirely. If that was a problem on a lot of, you know, early Ethereum exchanges where if someone else took the order you were trying to take, you would have to select a different order to take. So yeah, definitely going for a Uniswap or instant exchanger-esque UX, not a centralized exchange at this time.
Will you guys be working with any of these other DEX projects? I know like Decred has a DEX that's in the works, Havino like just launched, Basic Swap is another one that gets thrown around a lot. Like, will you work with any of these other DEXs to kind of have swaps between the different decentralized exchanges?
I think the most you would see is like a user interface which offers to do a swap through Sarai or offers to do a swap over, you know, Aveno, like kind of an aggregator in that, way. I don't actually think you would want direct integration in that you don't want Decred DEX doing swaps against Sarai because there is no Decred DEX. It's not a single entity. It's all of the users on it. And all of the users on it want to do atomic swaps, yet Sarai isn't doing atomic swaps. And there's a variety of reasons. Technically, it shouldn't. So because there's all of this variety of technical reasons, to be clear, I'm not saying that users don't benefit from the security of atomic swaps. They clearly do. And it would be great if there was a incredibly scalable, high UX design to do atomic swaps. In my opinion, there isn't. Hence why Sarai isn't doing atomic swaps and is doing decentralized swaps premised on threshold multi-signature wallets. Yes, because I believe that strikes the best balance of decentralization, security, and user experience. For those threshold multi-sigs to then do atomic swaps, it's not impossible. It just opens up a lot of denial of service vectors against Sarai, which could be used to attack the network quite decently.
Okay.
The issue with atomic swaps is that you start execution at one point in time, and then you don't actually do execution until, say, 30 minutes later. And because there's this delay between start and execution, it allows a lot of arbitrage, and that you are trading 30 minutes in the past.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So we're not really looking to do like Decred DEX against Sarai because one's atomic swaps, one's non-atomic swaps. If anything, we'd look to find a user interface that integrated Decred DEX, and then that user interface is like, hey, you can do atomic swap against this person or you can do a swap with Sarai. And it would give you like the different prices and quotes for that.
Okay. And I guess like the same principle would apply to Basic Swap because it's also using atomic swaps.
And Havino, which is not doing atomic swaps. They're doing just peer-to-peer swaps in their own way.
Yeah.
But yeah, the whole point is like the future is user interfaces that let the user choose, not necessarily direct connections on our end.
Okay. And with a platform like Covino, it requires like moderation. Like there's room there for like someone to try to get over on another user. And then there's like a moderator that would need to step in and kind of resolve that dispute. How does that process work in Sarai? Like, is there even a need for like moderation?
Yeah. So that's commentary from, you know, Covino not doing atomic swaps. They do have this moderation step. For Sarai, the entire process is automatic, and so long as 2/3 of validators are operating as expected, it just happens. It's not like, oh, this one person went offline, go talk to the moderators. No, as long as 2/3 of validators are operating as expected, it should just be automatic. If those validators had less than 2/3 operating as expected, they would go silent. And they would not, you know, report new events. They would not execute swaps, so on and so on. And then after an extended period of time, if they don't come back online and it's not like, oh, yeah, there's no technical issue, they just legitimately turned off their nodes. At that point, we would look at slashing them. And with that slash process, seizing their stake and using their stake to reimburse or to offset the losses, I'm not sure what term is best there actually, of any users who provided liquidity or had swaps in flight, so on and so on. And that stake should, the value of that stake is expected to exceed the value of the liquidity and the value of the in-flight swaps. And because it's expected to so exceed liquidity in in-flight swaps, even if we do get to this worst case scenario, it shouldn't be, oh yeah, you got 10 cents back on your dollar. No, it is expected to actually fully offset the losses. The only reason it wouldn't is if, one, there were drastic price movements that before the amount of stake updated, you know, it was already insufficient, or two, when all of that stake suddenly hits the market, that itself causes the price to dip a bit, which is as expected, which is why there's a buffer, so on and so on. The end point is, the idea is, yes, the stake would be more than the lost liquidity in in-flight swaps.
Okay. And like, besides staking, like, is the Sarai token going to give people like discounts on fees or like anything like that, like we see on other DEXs?
Yeah. So the Sarai coin is used for staking. It's also used, as one half of all liquidity. So if you want to do Bitcoin to Monero, you don't actually do Bitcoin to Monero, you do Bitcoin to Sarai to Monero. Okay. And that kind of just unifies the liquidity pools. It means if we add small coin number 5 million, if we have small coin number 5 million, it's not going to be like, oh yeah, you have one Bitcoin of liquidity against Bitcoin, but no liquidity against Ether. If you want to swap to Ether, you have to manually do the swaps yourself, or, you know, go through this Ether liquidity pool that has one way of liquidity in it. No, it's all of its, you know, that one Bitcoin value would be in Sarai. And then as soon as you swap to Sarai, you would immediately be able to swap to anything else. And UIs are expected to fully automatically handle this. And there is, you know, also on-chain code for enabling this. Yeah, it just unifies liquidity a bit. And it also technically, this is important for us, it gives us the value of, say, Bitcoin in terms of Sarai. And that's necessary because, as I said, the amount of stake is expected to exceed the amount of liquidity and the amount of in-flight swaps with a buffer. So in order to do that, we actually need to, of course, know the value of Bitcoin relative to the value of the stake. So having the liquidity pool so structured gives us a price oracle.
Okay. And like, what incentives do people have to provide liquidity? Do they earn like a return for like locking their Bitcoin?
Yeah, there's fees and emissions.
Well, that sounds super exciting. I can't wait till you guys come out with like a beta version that is on mainnet that we can start trying to use for real trades.
If it's on mainnet, it's not going to be in beta. I don't personally appreciate launching mainnets and then saying, oh, it's just an alpha. Oh, it's just a beta. Oh, it's just whatever it is. I believe users are going to kind of do whatever the hell users want. So if you give them a product that runs on mainnet, even if it's labeled just an alpha, that doesn't change that you're going to have this full mainnet experience. And if you're having this full mainnet experience, I believe your code should be up to snuff and you should be ready for it.
How will the Sarai tokens be produced? Like, are you guys doing like a token launch or something like that? Or is it just through like depositing liquidity that it like mints tokens, or how does that process work?
Yeah. So users who provide Bitcoin to be used as liquidity at launch, and not just Bitcoin, but also Ether, DAI, and Monero, they can kind of just put it up and they will be airdropped the Sarai coin into their liquidity positions. If they then remove their liquidity, that airdropped Sarai is not going to be returned. It's going to be burnt. But once we reach economic security, once we have enough validator stake and actually stake so much value that, yes, they do have more staked value than liquidity. When that happens, we kind of switch over to economic security and the rules change a bit. And with that, the Sarai that was airdropped starts trickle feeding. So if you remove, you know, one day in, you'll get like 1%. If you remove 50 days in, you'd get 50%. Except I believe we're looking at a 1 year trickle feed, not a 100 day trickle feed. So one day in, you get 0.03%. Or yeah, 0.3, sorry.
I'm going to change the subject a little bit here. I want to get into the Darrow stuff because, like, right before you published your paper, I had done a Darrow podcast because I was genuinely curious about Darrow. Like, I always see Darrow shills on my timeline. So I decided to keep an open mind, have someone from the Darrow project, well, who I later found out was not from the Darrow project, but is a Darrow developer and is working on projects within the ecosystem, secret name basis. He was actually super cool. He was really nice when he came on the show. He was patient, explained everything to me. I'm kind of a layman. I'm not as technical as people like you. So, he explained the way Darrow works and gave me a pretty good overview. And then literally like 3 or 4 days after I published the podcast, your paper came out and the Darrow community went into an uproar and it created like a huge controversy. I saw you going back and forth with TechLeaks, I think his name was, who later appeared on Doug's podcast and tried to defend his welching on the bet that he made you. Did he ever give you any Darrow at all?
Nope. I've never held any Darrow, so that continues to stay the same.
Okay. And then I saw that he was actually the first person that you've ever blocked on social media. You posted something.
Yeah, it was a 7-year run. I've done my best to be patient over those 7 years, but nice. Some people test your patience to that degree.
Yeah, I guess so. So I guess like, explain to us who are not so technical what exactly it is that you were able to accomplish as far as like de-anonymizing Darrow and then like what ramifications that has for the Darrow ecosystem.
Yeah, so I published a disclosure just over a week ago. It may actually be like just under 2 weeks ago by now. That caused a lot of discussion, and then eventually, people kind of accepted it was real. After 1 week, I published the proof of concept, which should fully settle any remaining doubts because now there's the code. You can go and run it yourself. Oh, sorry. The other thing I wanted to highlight is that shortly after the proof of concept was published, I did an episode of, quote, Breaking Darrow in an homage to Breaking Monero. Yeah, and that's really great at going over the technicals of this. And if you do want to fully understand the technicals, you're welcome to. Talking about here, I more want to just give a high level. So anyone who is not going to go out of the way to watch Breaking Darrow, but is a follower of your podcast, is kind of just up to date. Basically, Darrow encrypts what they call a payload with every transaction. And this payload is always there. It's not something you avoid. And it's usable for a variety of things, such as, you know, like payment IDs. They don't call it payment IDs. They call it destination ports, I believe. But you would put a payment ID there, or you could put like a human message if you wanted to. But even if you don't put either of those there, this field is still there and it still enables this attack or this bug or this exploit or whatever you want to call it. They encrypted the payload with a specific bit, a specific randomness value multiplied by the public key of the receiver. And that's a very traditional elliptic curve Diffie-Hellman. But then as part of the transaction, they publish an ElGamel commit, commitment for the amount. And the ElGamel commitment is of the form,
randomness times the receiver's public key plus the amount. So the two are identical because they did reuse the randomness for this. And the only part that's different is one is plus the amount and one is not plus the amount. So what that enables is you can just say, hey, is this the decryption key? No. Okay, subtract one. Is it the decryption key now? Subtract one. Is it the decryption key now? And if at the end you find the decryption key and you subtracted 10 Darrow, well, you know the amount is 10 Darrow. Because you tried it for a specific recipient, you know this person is the recipient of the transaction. And you can decrypt whatever's in the payload, whether it be, you know, a payment ID, whether it be a human message, whether it be whatever it is. So, yeah. And then this, the kind of final nail here was they did intend to put the sender in the payload as well. Like by default, Darrow is going to say, hey, you got this transaction. It was from this person. The default policy was to include the sender as some form of identification, as a return address. I don't actually fully know. But regardless, the intent was for anytime you receive Darrow for it to tell you the sender. That was actually bugged for, I think, over 2 years. And that it meant to tell you the sender. It literally put the receiver in that field. And you can't really argue, oh, it meant to put the receiver in that field, because I promise you the receiver knows who they themselves are. You don't. That's not something that needs to be specified. So the documentation was for it to be the sender. I think some user interfaces called it the sender. So it'd be like, oh, here's the sender, yourself. And it would be like, no, that's not correct. Regardless, the intent was for it to be the sender. And 6 months ago, someone did correct it to put in the sender there. Personally, I wouldn't put the sender in that field. I don't necessarily believe anyone I send money to should know that I sent the money. But regardless, that was the design decision they made, and it was correctly implemented 6 months ago. But because they're now putting the sender into this payload field, if you manage to decrypt the payload, you also break the sender. You also find the sender, which means this got amount privacy, receiver privacy, payload privacy, and sender privacy all out of the way.
Wow. Okay, so yeah, that's different than what TechLeaks was saying, because he was saying it was just the amounts and that you really didn't like de-anonymize the users, and right, that's why he didn't want to give you your 10,000 Darrow and this and that. But
so the sender privacy isn't something that's explicit. It's only for something with wallets that have the last 6 months of source code. Like this update to the source code only happened 6 months ago, yada, yada, yada. So sender privacy is only guaranteed for those. Well, sender privacy is only broken for those wallets. And it turns out a lot of people haven't updated. I think the official Darrow releases are a year old. I think technically like 11 months, but it doesn't matter for the purposes of this. I think the official Darrow releases are roughly a year old. I think Ngram, this wallet that seems to be frequently recommended, is roughly a year old. So for those wallets, they aren't affected because they don't have this, which corrects embedding the sender, which also, when the payload is decrypted, enables finding the sender. The issue with TechLeaks, so we don't really need to discuss. I love them for a reason, but I claim to be able to break receiver privacy, amount privacy, message privacy, and sender privacy for some transactions. And they're like, okay, if you can de-anonymize this transaction, you can have it. So in my opinion, it would be de-anonymization to the degree claimed. I don't believe that it's fair to assume that de-anonymization must go past the degree claimed, because I'm only claiming a specific degree. And then they got pissy because I didn't claim to be able to de-anonymize the sender. I only claim to be able to de-anonymize the sender for wallets newer than 6 months. But that also tells me their wallet is older than 6 months, which is its own fascinating bit of data. Not because it's useful, just because if you are actually looking at transactions on Moss, that actually is valuable information. If you're like, oh yeah, this account made a new transaction, therefore they must have updated their wallet software. If we know they're using new wallet software, we can kind of start decreasing the likelihood they're involved in this transaction, which used old wallet software. There are still like some interesting attacks when you get into the theory based on that. Anyways, and then they're they said it had to be complete de-anonymization after the fact. And it was actually multiple days after the fact. They first conceded I won, then said they weren't going to pay, then said they never had any intention of paying, then called me slurs. And I'm not sure slurs is the right term. They started calling me horrible things. Call me a whore. Yeah. And actually made some explicit comments in that regard. Like, it was part of their analogy, but that doesn't change that in their analogy, they made explicit comments towards me I really don't appreciate. And then like a couple of days later, they're like, well, I know I said you won, and I know I said I had no intention of paying, but actually it doesn't matter anyways, because you didn't win because anonymity, the de-anonymization must be complete, despite me only saying de-anonymization and you saying to the degree you could de-anonymize. And then I actually did come back on a separate note, and I'm like, hey, so if I publish your sender address now and I provide evidence for it and I show that I'm not just randomly guessing, because obviously they're only using a ring of 8 senders. For any ring-based solution, whether it be, you know, Monero, Darrow, whatever, you're going to have weaker privacy and there are going to be statistical attacks upon it. It doesn't matter if it's the UTXO or account model, even though that may change what statistical attacks are possible. I'm like, hey, I have with pretty high odds your address, like very, very high odds. If I tell you it and show you a methodology and you confirm I'm correct, well, then I will have told you the sender receiver amount and message. Therefore, I would have won the bet. And also, for this bet, you explicitly gave me 10 years with the answer. And they're like, no, it doesn't count. You already answered. And I'm like, I didn't answer sender. That was your whole complaint. And they're like, but you already answered on everything else, and that counts. And it's like, yeah, okay. You said you had no intention of paying. Whatever stupid bet you want to make with me obviously was not in good faith, because you literally confessed it was not in good faith. I'm just going to be done with this. So that was that whole bit of drama. But I do want to be clear that TechLeaks is one person who is their own person, and regardless of their issues, that does not inherently follow to other people nor projects.
Okay, fair enough. And is there anything, in your opinion, as a security researcher, that Darrow could have done differently to prevent you from finding this exploit?
Let's not talk about stopping me from finding the exploit. Let's talk about stopping the exploit from existing.
Okay.
So like basic rule of thumb, don't reuse randomness. That was the issue here. This randomness was reused. And if you reuse randomness in two completely different processes that are both black boxes, it's not really an issue. The issue is that these aren't different processes. One of these multiplied it by the recipient public key. The other multiplied it by the recipient public key and added the amount. And that's not enough of a difference. And in general, the rule of thumb is don't reuse randomness at all. Like truly, just don't reuse randomness. But technically, yes, there are some cases you can get away with it, but let's not get into it. So that kind of rule of thumb being broken was just really a red flag. What Darrow could do, and it's just document their code, document what it's intending to do, and have people audit that it does in fact meet those intentions. And then all claims about, you know, privacy, security, so on and so on, should be based off that documented intent. So you should have like the claim functionality, the procedure, which is claimed to meet that functionality, and this gets like formally and academically reviewed. Then you have the code, which is verified to match the procedure. Darrow could do that level of definition, and they could do that level of review and auditing. Unfortunately, I believe in the past, they haven't gotten audits on the claim that their cryptography is too advanced for any auditor. And as someone who works as a security researcher and someone who has worked with auditors, no, there are a bunch of auditors who have high quality cryptographers who absolutely could work with this. So one issue would be that they actually have to understand what they're meaning to be doing. Like, if you just hand them a pile of cryptography and say, audit this, it's like, what am I auditing? Is this a private value transfer system? Is this trying to encrypt messages? Is this trying to have my toaster make me a piece of toast? Like, you can only audit a system towards what it's supposed to be. So if you never document what it's supposed to be, it's very hard to audit that. And of course, Darrow does make a lot of claims about what it is. And I'm not, like, it does say, oh, it's a private value transfer system, so on and so on, and it has all of this functionality. But that doesn't change when you're dealing with a blob of cryptography. You're like, okay, is this amount privacy? Is this sender privacy? Is this receiver privacy? Because if you just tell me Darrow is a sender private transfer system and have me audit it, I'd be like, well, it's only partially sender private in that it uses rings. So instead of being sender private to one of any account on the blockchain, it's one of these accounts in the ring. And if you're like, oh, well, that's intentional. We have, you know, this more limited definition of sender privacy, which I actually would still call sender privacy. I would still call using rings a form of sender privacy. How good it is a whole nother discussion. But if you now say, oh, well, it's meaning to be using rings because that's efficient and within our grasp. Okay, yeah, sure. That changes my audit. That changes it from you're not doing sender privacy over the complete chain to, yeah, you are actually meeting your claims. But that's the issue. You kind of have to have all of these claims documented, and then you have to have the methodology documented. And then even if this cryptography code isn't broken, that's not a formal security proof. And if you're deploying cryptography, you really should have formal security proofs. So now my next question is, cool, here's the algorithm implemented as I notated it myself. Where's your formal security proof for it? Because if you're deploying math without a formal security proof, that's its own issue. And I believe Darrow actually implemented, but I don't just believe, their algorithm matches almost entirely. It's only a couple of lines different from a JP Morgan paper on anonymous Ether, anonymous Z Ether, which was a proposed way to privately transfer Ether using rings. And I'm like, okay, so if I compare this to the anonymous Ether claims, which is not only an academic algorithm, but also has security claims built in and is eligible for further academic review, I can say, oh, well, for this paper, you have this differences, but all of this is the same, if there are any notable differences. But that doesn't change that unless you confirm with me that is the paper intended to implement. I'm kind of just picking a random paper that is 99% correct. But if I build my audit off of that, and then you come back on this other paper, and you're like, no, this is the paper we implemented, every single line matches exactly. It's like, cool, well, now my audit findings are validated again, because I had to guess what you wanted, and it didn't line up. So if there were any issues with auditors, I truly don't think it was too advanced for them. I think it's all auditing is a point of comparison. And there's nothing to compare it to, not because there's no other projects with this level, because there's no documentation for it. There's no formally stated intent. There's no formally stated method of achieving that intent. So it can't be compared to any intentions. It's just, does this look fine or not? And it's, well, does it look fine at making me toast? No, it doesn't make me toast. This does not look fine. But does it look fine as a private value transfer system? Maybe. Let's talk about it. So I really think that the Darrow project should move to documentation, formalization, formal security proofs, and auditing.
Why do you think it is that they haven't like followed these common procedures that other projects employing this kind of encryption would follow?
I honestly don't know, because just acknowledging the JP Morgan paper would have done a lot for it. Like, legitimately, I wasn't aware that was the specific paper implemented for several months. I knew in general it was the anonymous Zether construction, which this JP Morgan paper was an evolution of. I didn't actually know it was that specific JP Morgan paper for a while. Or at least I'm presuming. Again, I have no confirmation of this. It's not documented in the code. It's so incredibly close. I don't see a way where you say it isn't. If you say it isn't, I feel like you would have to say it's our slight modifications to it in our own paper. But practically, it is this paper. So the fact that they didn't, you know, cite the paper and immediately gain all that formal background, I truly have no idea. I don't know if it was to obfuscate it and make it harder to review, which so many issues with that theory, if that is the case. I don't know if it's to try to, you know, claim, oh, we built this system, and not acknowledge how it's building off of all of this academic work, but done by another person and group. I truly don't know. All I can hope is for it to be done in the future.
Okay. And then Body Anarchist on Doug's podcast was saying that Darrow, I guess, did some other red flag kind of behavior when they implemented bulletproofs. They implemented them before they were like audited or reviewed by security researchers. Is it common, like in the Darrow ecosystem, that they cut corners like this with their encryption and their security and privacy?
I really can't speak on their history just because I'm not completely aware of that. what I can say is for the process of, you know, deploying these protocols, what should be done is a formal protocol is stated with all of the claims and security proofs. Those security proofs are then reviewed, which are kind of like auditing the paper itself. Mm-hmm. And then once you have this protocol, which not only has these claims and not only has proofs to meet those claims and not only has been reviewed so that you can, you know, trust that it does, yes, in fact, meet those claims, then what you would look at is implementing that protocol and auditing it to match that protocol. So in that way, it's arguably a five-step process. It's paper, proofs, review of the proofs, implementation, audit. The allegation, as I understand it, is that it was bulletproofs with proofs, or the security proofs for it. Then there was no academic review at the time. Then they did the implementation. Then they did the, sorry, my fingers don't bend that way. Then they didn't audit it. So my understanding is the accusation is they skipped out on the academic review and the auditing of their work. I would call that cutting corners if that's actually what happened. I'd have to go back and see if that's actually what happened. And I can even like point out my own work. My own work, we took bullet proofs, we slightly modified it. We got security proofs even for slight modifications. Now we're currently trying to reach out to get review on our slight modifications. We have an implementation and we're planning to audit that implementation. We're kind of trying to hit all of those notes and really be confident in this because this stuff matters.
Yeah, I agree. If people are relying on it for privacy, which could be like life mm-hmm. and death circumstances, it definitely matters. Another thing that the Darrow people like to shout about is the fully homomorphic encryption that Darrow claims to have. Mm-hmm. Yet I saw, I'm not sure if it was a paper that you wrote or if it was like a long thread on Twitter where you were saying that they don't have fully homomorphic encryption and you provided like a bunch of reasons for why you doubted this claim. Can you kind of like recap that for us briefly?
So, in academic terms, and this is part of the issue with Darrow, they've developed a lot of their own terminology. Let's scope it a bit better. In any cryptocurrency community, the obvious majority is going to be people who do not understand the technology. Mm. And that's not an attack on them. It's actually kind of what you want. If someone is, you know, sending Bitcoin, sending Monero, you don't want them to realize, oh yeah, and as I send this transaction, it's being signed with a digital signature and that's being sent to the block. No, they just want to think they're sending money. Mm-hmm. They shouldn't have to understand all of these inner workings and exactly how they work. So in the academic sense, homomorphic encryption is any encryption with homomorphs. Homomorphisms. Homomorphisms being like 1 + 2, that's 3. The encryption of 1 plus the encryption of 2 is the encryption of 3. That would be additively homomorphic. If you add 2 encryptions, it is equivalent to adding the values that were encrypted.
So you add a hash with another hash and it creates the sum of like what the hash would be if you...
You just hash your sum of the original values.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, if you have an additively homomorphic hash, yeah. Mm-hmm. And there are examples of that. So in this case, we're not discussing hash functions, we're discussing encryption, which is different. Okay. But yeah, additively homomorphic encryption has been around since 80s, 90s. I'm not sure exactly when the first scheme was posited, but a lot of her cryptography, honestly, like a lot of it dates back to the 90s. And yeah, additively homomorphic encryption has been around for a while. One of the famous systems being the El-Gamal system, where you can add and subtract. But there was kind of this goal for fully homomorphic encryption, where you don't just have addition, but you also have multiplication. Because if you have addition and multiplication, you have completed all mathematical operations. And to phrase this in a way that may make a bit more sense, with addition and multiplication alone, you can do every single binary gate that we need to operate computers today. Like all computers today devolve into, you know, and, or, not, XOR, exclusive NOR gates. so on and so on. And addition and multiplication let you represent every single one of them. So because addition and multiplication can represent every single gate, it is kind of just this complete set of mathematical opcodes that let you build whatever program you want and do whatever you want. So ElGamel only has addition, does not have multiplication. And it actually predates a system with multiplication, predates a system with addition and multiplication, but I think by over 10 years. The first system to do addition and multiplication was Gentry's PhD work in 2009. So it's actually quite recent in the grand time.
2009? Yeah, that is pretty recent considering the rest of it comes from the 90s.
Yeah, additively homomorphic systems came from the 90s. And then for decades, like just no one could crack it until finally, 2009 Gentry did. From what I've heard, it took 30 seconds to do any operation with it. Like you want to add or multiply? Yeah, that's going to be 30 seconds. Please wait a minute. So fully homomorphic encryption, it's just really slow. And obviously there's been development since 2009. And now it's at a point where it's tolerable at small scales. But to deploy fully homomorphic encryption over an entire blockchain network with any decent level of performance, that would be a notable step up in performance. It'd no longer be revolutionary. There are a few networks working at deploying FHE at the scale. I think one of the solutions they're trying to do is like FPGAs. FPGAs being field programmable gate arrays. It's, to simplify it, it's a piece of hardware that you can like plug in over USB and you can program it to do things. But unlike running the program on your computer, this actually configures the hardware of the device itself and it can just run hundreds of times faster. So if you know it takes 10 seconds on our computer, but you plug in this USB and you program it as expected, well, now you're actually effectively changing how it acts as a hardware device. So it's going to be 100 times faster because hardware is faster than software. It's one of the steps between, here's a computer program, here's the FPGA, and here's actually dedicated tailor-made hardware. It's one of the steps you would move to while building an ASIC, and it would be in design and development of that. But one of the great things is you never actually have to produce the ASIC. If the FPGA itself is fast enough, you can just buy an off-the-shelf FPGA, load whatever hardware you want it to act as on it, and start using it as if it was that hardware. So I think some of these networks are discussing FPGAs. Like everyone who is actually doing the encryption would need to plug in this device. And then you only have the validators do it. And then the validators can like produce ZK proofs they did it correctly, which everyone else can just verify, so on and so on. But yeah, it's definitely this very computationally extensive process. So ElGamel is partially homomorphic because it only has some of all of the possible homomorphisms. It has addition, you can add, which is the one homomorphism it has, but it doesn't have multiplication, where, of course, the complete set, again, is addition and multiplication. So Darrow did deploy this partially homomorphic system, and because of that, it's not fully homomorphic encryption, which is why I don't like the claim it's fully homomorphic encryption, because to practically claim it's fully homomorphic encryption is to claim we solved all of this design, development, technical difficulties with deploying such a system at scale, and it just fundamentally wasn't solved. The reason Darrow claims to have fully homomorphic encryption is because while they only use a partially homomorphic encryption system, they always use it. Therefore, all data is fully homomorphic encrypted. And
it's like a semantical thing.
It's very frustrating. They're saying, we don't need multiplication, and because we always use this encryption, it's always on homomorphic encryption. You know what else you call always on homomorphic encryption? Full.
Cool.
And it's like, the issue is that the industry, the academics, other developers, researchers, everyone else other than your community, which to be quite honest, is quite small in the grand scheme of things. And I'm not saying that to mock them. I'm saying Darrow is a project. You can believe Darrow is a promising project. You can believe Darrow has chops. You can do whatever you want. That does not change the size of the Darrow community. It does not compare to the size of the entire field of academia that we're discussing here.
And words have meanings.
If everyone else
saying this word with a specific meaning behind it, mm-hmm. and you're changing the meaning and employing the word in a similar fashion, you're just creating confusion.
Right. So that's my frustration with anyone calling it fully homomorphic encryption. It's just, it's not per everyone else's definition. The best argument is that it's always on homomorphic encryption, but then the issue is it's not always on. If you call a smart contract, one of the things you can do is transfer data to a smart contract. If you transfer data to a smart contract, it's not homomorphically encrypted. It publicly reveals it. And it's like, oh yeah, but it's meant to be public. So the smart contract, you know, so anyone can see how much balance the smart contract has. Cool. But then what's the scope of this full? Is it full within the private transfer system? So like, it's not full within the Darrow network. It's only full within the private transfer system. And then you just have to create so many caveats. I just wish that people would be honest. And I'm not here to say everyone claiming it's fully homomorphic encryption is dishonest. If they've heard it's fully homomorphic encryption and they're not technical, I don't want to yell at them for repeating that. I just want to be clear. No, you should not be repeating that. Amounts are homomorphically encrypted with regards to user accounts and users' transfers. It's encrypted with a partially homomorphic system. There is no fully homomorphic system deployed. And the challenges towards one have not been solved as needed by Darrow. And it does matter because, not just because of, you know, the claims of success, not just that aspect. If they had multiplications, one of the things that could be done is actually like private smart contracts, which is another thing they claim to have, which they do not have at all. That one, no, they fundamentally do not have. But with regards to one of the things you can do is you can have a, let's say there's this loan platform where you can deposit Ether and take out a loan in, you know, USDT.
Okay.
So this has been, you know, Compound, Aave, a bunch of different Ethereum platforms offer this.
Yeah.
As of right now, everyone can see at what price you get liquidated at. So that enables people to, you know, attack the price of Ether and try to force you to be liquidated. If you have fully homomorphic encryption, one of the things you can do is a loan platform where all of the loans are encrypted. And because all of the loans are encrypted, you actually can't see anyone's liquidation prices. And only if the liquidation price is hit and it's time to liquidate, only then would the loan information be decrypted as necessary to enable liquidation. So like, yeah, if you do have fully homomorphic encryption and you have a group of validators with the encryption key who are responsibly executing that encryption key and only decrypting when the network says to, you actually can get private smart contracts and get a lot of interesting functionality out of it. It is a thing that should be worked towards, in my opinion. Which is, again, one of the frustrations of why, oh yeah, we don't have multiplications, but we don't need them, so we're just going to claim that terminology anyways.
So I guess the motivation behind them misrepresenting the type of encryption that they're employing is so that they can pretend that they have private smart contracts, even though they don't? Or like, why are they...
No. I think whoever started the claim and whoever actively propagates the claim, despite knowing this, I think it's just a bit of ego. I think it depends on whether or not you think the people are, I think they're knowingly trying to cause confusion. I think they're trying to claim fully homomorphic encryption because fully homomorphic encryption is a very important, very valuable discussion with a lot of research and effort going into it. And I think they want to be able to claim Darrow already solved this and Darrow already does this, despite Darrow not already solving this and doing it. I've explicitly seen posts about Ethereum layers, which are trying to add fully homomorphic encryption, per what I just said, you know, smart contracts that are only decrypted when they should be decrypted. So you can have a loan without people knowing what your liquidation information is. You can have a human peer-to-peer debt platform where you post your email on the blockchain, but your blockchain is only decrypted if you need to be contacted for some reason. I don't like that idea, actually. I'm just trying to create some examples to try to demonstrate this. But the point is, it's like, there actually are Ethereum layers that are trying to deploy fully homomorphic encryption at scale and enable all this functionality. And I've seen some tweets directly saying, oh, you don't need to wait for these Ethereum layers. Darrow already does this. But no, those Ethereum layers are trying to offer smart contracts where the data they operate over is encrypted. And Darrow fundamentally does not offer smart contracts where the data you operate over is encrypted. And for that to be done in a proper manner, you practically need fully homomorphic encryption, which again, Darrow does not have. So I do think it's just trying to claim that Darrow is great by using on purposely confusing and misleading terms. To anyone who propagates that claim, despite knowing how everyone else is going to see that claim.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for that explanation. Because like I said, I'm not like a cryptographer and I didn't know enough when I did the podcast with Secret Name Basis, like when he was making these claims, to push back on it because I just was out of my depth, you know? So thanks for like breaking that down for me in a way that was easy to understand. Assuming like somebody does, like not saying Darrow, but like some project out there, one of these Ethereum layer twos maybe, makes like some sort of breakthrough cryptographically to where they can employ these fully homomorphic smart contracts that you're describing. Like, will those scale? Because I know like with the full chain membership proofs and bullet proofs, like people say like, oh, Monero transactions are like too big, like they don't scale, like Bitcoin already doesn't scale. Like, and then full chain membership proofs are going to make the transactions a little bit bigger, which may negatively impact scaling. So like with these fully homomorphic, like smart contracts, like is this like a lot bigger? Like,
yeah. So, they're going to use a lot more data. So if you're concerned about like the vertical scalability of it, they are going to use a lot more data. And then also, as I said, they may require, you know, additional hardware, like hardware that isn't standard in computers be used if you're the ones operating over the encrypted data. But one of the things you can do is once you operate over it, you can create a ZK proof, and then everyone else, they don't actually have to, or rather not a ZK proof, a succinct proof. You know, like, oh, I have a proof of a program this big. My proof is this big, but it proves that this program is executed correctly, a succinct proof. Okay. A proof that's small and fast to verify despite representing a large program. So like one of the things you can do is you can have only one person. If you don't care about the decentralization of it, because it doesn't actually matter, they're still fully checked. The only issue is the denial of service. If this one person goes offline, you're waiting around a bit. But if you do only have one person, yeah, they can do all of the addition and multiplication, which back in 2009 took 37 each. And then they can just produce the ZK proof they did it correctly. And then everyone else can verify the ZK proof, know everything is correct. Or again, technically not a ZK proof, a succinct proof. Everyone else can just verify the proof that they did correctly. And that can take a few milliseconds, truly. Despite, you know, this encryption taking so long, the proof verification, which proves that all of the encryption was done correctly, can take just a few milliseconds. So it does increase data. It does increase the computational power a lot for whoever does the additions, does the multiplications. But if they also do a succinct proof that they did it correctly, you don't lose any verifiability. And the average node has much, doesn't have nearly as much of the computational load. If you want to compare the computational load to like Ethereum right now, I don't immediately know how those would compare. But I'm not here to say, oh, it's going to be 1,000 times slower. No, it actually should be feasible to run a node. You may have worse TPS, but it would be feasible. The one concern I do want to bring up with these networks where you have like smart contracts that are using fully homomorphic encryption, the validators do have to share the encryption key. Because at some point, you do want to decrypt this data. And the question is, okay, so to decrypt it, we need a decryption key. Who has that? And you can't give it to a random user because it doesn't belong to a random user. It belongs to the smart contract. Mm-hmm. And the smart contract belongs to no one. It's meant to be autonomously executed by the network. So if you now actually do need to supply a decryption key, you can't put it on the blockchain, then everyone has a copy of it. Someone needs to have it. And what these networks are doing is generally they're using a proof of stake or they're using a federation. And they're saying the validators are effectively the network. And the validators are trusted with the encryption key. And so long as the majority of validators agree, they can perform decryption.
If they're sharing,
and that is one.
Is that like a vulnerability, like, or an attack surface or anything like that?
Well, generally be threshold shared. So like any 2/3 of them could perform decryption, But as long as, you know, 34% are honest, no one, only honest decryptions will happen. Because 34% are honest, the 66% trying to do a decryption won't have two-thirds. Two-thirds of 100 is technically, you know, 66.66666. So 66% is just under it. So even if they try to decrypt data they shouldn't, they won't have enough people to do the decryption.
Okay.
So it is an attack in that, yeah, if you do have 67% dishonest, yeah, they can decrypt the entire network, which is unfortunate. You can still argue it may be better than what we have today, because right now everyone can see your data. In this case, only that malicious group could see your data. But yeah, fully homomorphic encryption, it's definitely not as private as, when we're discussing smart contracts, it's not as private as a lot of other designs can be, but a lot of these other designs only do very specific things, and that's why they can be so private. With fully homomorphic encryption and smart contracts, we're literally discussing any possible operation being done. And when you have to say, oh yeah, my, you know, the space of possibilities is this big, yeah, sure, you can divide, you can design private systems with great properties. But now when the space is this big, no, you do kind of have to fall back to this issue, because there are certain possibilities which require that and could not have a more efficient ZK system designed. So to Dara's credit, that's one of the great things about using homomorphic encryption for value transfer and explicitly value transfer, not for smart contracts as a whole, is they can design a very narrow system that is completely private within that. With Darrow, there's no validators who hold the decryption keys. Users hold their encryption keys for themselves. And that works. And it's kind of one of the arguments, oh yeah, Darrow always uses homomorphic encryption for user balances. Sure. And those, again, completely held by the user. There's no validators with the decryption key. It's just the issue when you try to apply it to smart contracts, where now there is no human user. It's a smart contract. It's autonomous, that you run into these difficulties, which is another reason why it's a very complex problem. And there's a lot of discussion about it. And there's a lot of efforts to get something that's feasible. And even if it requires, you know, this extra piece of hardware for the validators, that extra piece of hardware still needs to be designed. It still needs to be cost effective. It still needs to work with sufficiently off the shelf parts, so on and so on. So it's a very interesting and very complex field.
With the success that we've seen with like Ethereum and DeFi and like these decentralized platforms, you've given several different examples. Like, I believe that like private smart contracts are one of like the next things that we need to figure out, like as an industry, for crypto to keep advancing in like a decentralized peer-to-peer way. Which like implementation or approach to private smart contracts is like the one that you see as either the most feasible or the one that you're most excited about?
I don't actually really know much of the details about the specific people trying to do private smart contracts. I know their names. I've read one or two of their white papers, which should give me a lot of their technical info, except those were dated years ago, and I'm not sure how it's changed since then. And also, I don't remember whose white papers I read. So I don't want to say, oh, yeah, this one project had this white paper, and it's like, no, that's the white paper for this other project. Generally, what you're looking for is some combination of ZK proofs and fully homomorphic encryption. So, like, instead of your... let's say it's Ethereum, which we're discussing. Instead of your Ethereum balance being homomorphically encrypted, letting anyone see your balance, or letting the validators, if they're malicious, see your balance, generally what you would discuss is having the Ethereum balance be this value transfer system I discussed, which is a very narrow problem, which you can do without homomorphic encryption, or as Darrow has done, with user-held keys, partially homomorphic encryption. So you would discuss like having balances be some traditional ZK system where the user maintains their privacy, and then only the smart contracts would be fully homomorphic encryption where the validators hold the decryption key. And there definitely have been a few different blockchains posited on this, you know, and you can even take it further where you have smart contracts and you write your smart contracts so that some fields are public as necessary. You know, like with Uniswap, you need the amount of tokens the pool has to be public. So you can have it where some data is public, some data is encrypted, and then some data is completely private. It's only known by the user. And then when the user wants to make an interaction, they say, here's my ZK proof over this data. Here's the public results. This now gets applied to these homomorphically encrypted variables, so on and so on. So you are looking for something that does both. It's not just fully homomorphic encryption. It's not just ZK proofs, but it's a combination of ZK proofs and fully homomorphic encryption. I can only remember one name off the top of my head that was aiming to do both, and I don't only want to list one platform, so I'm going to hold off on naming specific projects, but there are a few.
Okay. And are you excited yourself, like personally, about the prospect of private smart contracts and like private DeFi, so to speak?
Personally, I'm much more interested in the narrow use cases, which avoid homomorphic encryption, you know, like Monero, private value transfer. It could have homomorphic encryption as Darrow did. I don't personally think that's worthwhile for a bunch of technical reasons, which I'll skip on. But yeah, like Monero being completely private with trustless zero knowledge proofs, that would be great in my opinion. And that wouldn't have any DeFi functionality, but it would be great. If there was an Ethereum that was ZK proofs for value transfer and then public DeFi, which is kind of what Darrow has posited itself as, you know, like private value transfer and public smart contracts. Yeah, no, I would prefer that. Like, I'm not trying to say, despite all the negative things about Darrow that we've discussed today, I'm not trying to say there's nothing bad about the project or there isn't an interesting intention towards it. It's just, unfortunately, it's hampered by a lack of review, a lack of friendliness with other communities, a lack of consistent advertising, which is considered honest to a variety of parties, et cetera, et cetera. But like, yeah, the basic premise, private value transfer, public smart contracts. Yeah, that's a massive step up from direct Ethereum and is something I would much prefer, assuming that it had the network effect of Ethereum and it also had the smart contract functionality of Ethereum. But yeah, if you told me Ethereum was getting private value transfer, I'd love that. If you also said contracts are going to be homomorphically encrypted with a key held by the validators, I guess I'd appreciate that more. I would practically assume my liquidation information isn't being given out, but I wouldn't trust its privacy for anything life or death. I wouldn't start posting personal messages on there.
Okay.
So yeah, like it's a step up in that it helps protect against MEV. This is the argument. It either helps protect against MEV, miner extractable value, because now miners can't see what's happening, or it just centralizes it because malicious validators are the only people who can see what's happening, which means they are the only people who can trade against you, which means that yes, if they are malicious, if they are malicious, they can actively trade against you. So that's the question. Is it protecting against, you know, miner extractable value and all of these economic attacks? Or is it just making it where only the validators are the ones to perform them? I would lean towards the former. I would argue practically it's unlikely these validators are counter-trading all of their users. And practically, yes, you're reducing miner extractable value. You're creating a fairer ecosystem for your decentralized finance. And that all sounds great to me. I just would not trust it as a completely private system. And I would say if you want, you know, this completely private system, it should not be using homomorphic encryption with a validator held decryption key, but it should be your data entirely and just using ZK proofs.
Well, thank you for your insight on that topic. Another question I want to ask you, I'm changing the subject drastically here. I'm going to take it back to Sarai, but the WowNero community wants to know if you have plans to include WowNero into Sarai at some point.
So I'm not confirming any integrations before mainnet. It's something I've said before, and it's something I'll continue saying. WowNero shouldn't be too difficult, as we already integrated Monero. And if you've solved all of the problems with Monero, the additional problems with WowNero are not really there. So it would be a question of where it falls on the priority list. You know, like there's Ethereum L2s, there's Bitcoin Cash, there's Litecoin, there's other privacy coins, there's a bunch of other projects. And I'm not sure we'll ever explicitly say no to any of them. I haven't said no yet. I'm not sure there's ever going to be a reason to explicitly say no to a project. So I'm not saying no to WowNero. It's just a question of when it makes sense to get around to it.
Okay. And would you be opposed to, I guess, the community themselves undertaking the integration? Like, I know, like, with projects like BTC Pay Server, for instance, they're not going to waste their own, like, small team of developers and resources trying to integrate all these other projects, but they open source the code and they invite other communities to create the integration themselves if they want to see it become reality.
Yeah. So Sarai is open source, and definitely would love to see other groups contributing integrations after mainnet. Because before mainnet, I absolutely won't merge them. And before mainnet, I don't make any guarantees about our internal stability. So you might write an integration, and then a month later, I might be, yeah, I deleted half of these functions. Here are the new ones. Please update. And I can tell you that, but that doesn't change that. That sucks. You wrote all this code. Now you have to rewrite it. Yeah. So after mainnet, we should be a bit more stable. And with that stability, it makes a lot more sense to to solicit integrations, because there's a much smaller chance I then tell you, please rewrite this integration. So after mainnet, I would love to see a community submitted integrations. At some point, there's probably going to be a process defined for that, whether formal or informal. It's probably going to be, you know, the integration is made. If it's direct and simple, it just needs the right people to review it. And then the validators would need to agree to it, and, you know, then it would be merged in and deployed. It's the actual deployment of it, which is the part that needs the validator's agreement, but practically we shouldn't merge anything that the validators won't agree to deploy. But yeah, if it's a more complex integration, like it's not just a one arrow, a fork of an arrow, but it's this complete independent integration, we'd have to discuss, you know, auditing procedures and having experts from that community review it and agree it's sane. But yeah, it's something I'd love to see happen, community integrations in general. And one of my focuses after mainnet will be my own set of integrations and expanding support there.
Okay. And your long-term vision for Sarai, do you see it like with, you know, like a whole bunch of coins, or do you want to keep it kind of small like Basic Swap is, where it's only got like 7 or 8 different coins?
Yeah. One of the things we did was make sure that the platform largely horizontally scales. It doesn't completely horizontally scale. All of the swaps happen on this layer one. But the reporting process, you know, oh, all of these Bitcoin events happen, put them on chain. We don't then have, you know, our 150 validators vote on chain. We don't say, yes, Bitcoin block happened. Yes, Bitcoin block happened. Yes, 150 times. We just publish a single event for that. So because we, regardless of how many validators for Bitcoin we have, we only publish a single event, that just greatly helps performance. And it gets compounded because we also don't have every single validator running a Bitcoin node, every single validator running an Ethereum node, every single validator running a Monero node, because then yes, we would have to say we don't have the feasibility. We can't expect to add more chains. There's just the validators are overwhelmed with their existing 10 nodes. So what we would move to discussing is, so because we don't have that requirement, instead what we're looking at is having 150 validators for Bitcoin alone, and then having 150 validators for Ethereum alone, and then having 150 validators for Monero alone. And because each validator only has to run their own, their coin of choice or coins of choice, and because these validators don't really need to communicate, adding new networks alone doesn't really increase, doesn't really decrease our performance. The only part of it that decreases our performance is we now have to handle the swaps from those networks. But if our network is failing to handle swaps, the solution isn't integrate more chains. The solution is to increase performance so that we can do more swaps.
Is there anything that I haven't asked you about that you want to tell the audience?
I mean, we did full chain membership proof. We did Sarai. We talked about Darrow. Then we had conversations about fully homomorphic encryption for a bit. I think we kind of covered everything.
Nice.
Very thorough.
Yeah. Okay, cool. I just didn't know if you had like something else you're working on that you want to let people know about or anything like that. But if you think we covered it all, man, I appreciate you being so generous with your time. Thanks for dealing with the technical difficulties that we had at the outset. And it was a pleasure talking to you, man.
Yeah. Great being on. Thanks for your time.